Chapter 12. Iothea. The ends of the earth shall be racked by the howls of the wicked, and the idols shall be cast down and shattered, stone against stone. And the demons of the idolaters shall hold open their mouths, like starving lepers, for no man living will answer their outrageous hunger. 16:4-22. The Witness of Fain. Though you lose your soul, you shall win the world. Mandate Catechism. Late summer, 4111, year of the tusk, Shigek. Zynemus didn't particularly like the man, and had never trusted him, but he'd nonetheless been trapped into speaking with him. The man, Thereshut, a baron of dubious reputation from Conria's frontier with High Anon, had intercepted him as Zynemus made his way from a planning session with Proyas. Upon seeing Zynemus, the man's thinly bearded face had brightened with his best, oh, how fortuitous look. It was in Zynemus's nature to be patient with even those he disliked, but distrust was a different matter altogether. And yet, it was the small indignities that the pious man must endure over all.
"I seem to remember, Lord Marshal," Thereshut said, hastening to match his pace, "that you have an affinity for books."
Ever polite, Zynemus nodded and said,
"An acquired taste." "Then you must be excited that the famed Sariotic library in Iothea was taken intact by the Galeoth."
"The Galeoth? I thought it was the Anoni."
"No,"
Thereshut replied, drawing his lips into a strange upside-down smile.
"I've heard that it was the Galeoth, men of Sorbonne's own household, in fact."
"Indeed,"
Zynemus said impatiently.
"Well, enough then."
"I see you're busy, Lord Marshal. No bother. I'll send one of my slaves to arrange an audience."
To bump into Thereshut was annoying enough, but to actually suffer through a formal visit?
"I'm never too busy for a baron of the land, Thereshut."
"Good,"
the man nearly squealed.
"Well then, not long ago, a friend of mine, well, I should say he's not yet my friend, but
he's someone you hope to carry favor with, Thereshut."
Thereshut's face both brightened and soured.
"Yes, although that sounds rather indelicate, don't you think?"
Zynemus said nothing but walked on, his eyes firmly fixed on the top of his pavilion amidst the jumble of others in the distance. Beyond, the hills of Gedea were pale in the haze.
"Shigek," he thought. "We've taken Shigek."
For some strange reason, the certainty that soon, impossibly soon, he'd set eyes on Holy Shima seized him.
"It's happening."
It was almost enough to make him be kind to Thereshut. Almost.
"Well, this friend of mine, who just returned from the Sariotic Library, asked me what Gnosis was, and since you're the closest thing to a scholar I know, I thought you could help me help him. Do you know what Gnosis is?"
Zynemus stopped and eyed the small man carefully.
"Gnosis," he said carefully, "is the name of the old sorcery of the ancient north."
"Ah, yes!" Thereshut exclaimed. "That makes sense."
"What interest does your friend have in libraries, Thereshut?"
"Well, you know there's a rumor that Sorbonne might sell the books to raise more money."
Zynemus hadn't heard this rumor, and it troubled him.
"I doubt the other great names would countenance that. So what? Your friend has already begun taking inventory?"
"He's a most enterprising soul, Lord Marshal.
A good man to know if one's interested in profits, if you know what I mean." "Merchant cast dog, no doubt,"
Zynemus said matter-of-factly.
"Let me give you some advice, Thereshut. Heed your station."
But rather than take offense at this, Thereshut smiled wickedly.
"Surely, Lord Marshal,"
he said in a tone devoid of all deference.
"You, of all people."
Zynemus blinked, astonished more by his own hypocrisy than by Baron Thereshut's insolence. A man who sups with a sorcerer, castigating another for currying favor with a merchant? Suddenly the hushed rumble of the Conryan camp seemed to buzz in his ears. With a fierceness that shocked him, The Marshal of Atrempus stared at Therashut, stared at him until, flustered, the fool mumbled insincere apologies and scurried away. As he walked the remaining distance to his pavilion, Zynemus thought of Achaemenion, his dear friend of many, many years. And he thought of his caste, and was faintly shocked by the hollow of uneasiness that opened in his gut when he recollected Therashut's words, "You of all people." How many think this? Their friendship had been strained of late, Zynemus knew. It would do them both some good if Achaemenion spent several days away, in a library, studying blasphemy.
"I don't understand," Esmonette said with more than a little anger. "He's leaving me."
Achaemenion heaved a burlap sack of oats across his mule's back. His mule, Daybreak, regarded her solemnly. Beyond him, the largely deserted encampment crowded the slopes, pitched among and between small stands of black willows and cottonwoods. She could see the Sempus in the distance, shining like obsidian inlay beneath the punishing sun. Whenever she glanced at the hazy south bank, dark with vegetation, she could feel the heathen watching.
"I don't understand, Akka," she repeated, plaintively this time.
"But Esme."
"But what?"
He turned to her, obviously irritated, distracted.
"It's a library. A library."
"So?"
she said hotly.
"The illiterate are not—"
"No,"
he snapped, scowling.
"No, look. I need some time alone. I need time to think. To think, Esme, think."
The desperation in his voice and expression shocked her into momentary silence.
"About Kellis,"
she said. The skin beneath her scalp prickled.
"About Kellis,"
he replied, turning back to his mule. He cleared his throat, spit into the dust.
"He's asked you, hasn't he?"
Her chest tightened.
Could it be?
Achaemenion said nothing, but there was a subtle heartlessness to his movements and almost imperceptible blankness to his eyes. She was learning him, she realized, like a song sung many times. She knew him.
"Asked me what?"
he said finally, tying his sleeping mat to the pack saddle.
"To teach him the Gnosis."
For the past 3 weeks, since following the Cynrian column into the Sempus Valley through the madness of the occupation, ever since the night with the Wathidal, a strange rigidity had seemed to haunt Achaemenion, a tension that made it impossible for him to love or laugh for anything more than moments. But she'd assumed his argument with Zynemus and their subsequent estrangement had been the cause. Several days earlier, she'd confronted the marshal on the issue, telling him of his friend's apprehensions. Yes, Achaemenion had committed an outrage, she explained, but he'd erred out of foolishness, not disrespect.
"He tries to forget Zin, but he cannot. Every morning I cradle him as he cries out. Every morning I remind him the apocalypse is over. He thinks Kellis is the harbinger."
But Zynemus, she could tell, already knew this. He was patient in tone, word, manner, everything save his look. His eyes had never truly listened, and she'd known something deeper was wrong. A man like Zynemus, Achaemenion had told her once, risked much keeping a sorcerer as a friend. She'd never pressed Achaemenion with anything more than warm reminders like,
"He worries for you, you know."
The hurts of men were brittle, volatile things. Achaemenion liked to claim that men were simple, that women need only feed, fuck, and flatter them to keep them happy. Perhaps this was true of certain men, perhaps not, but it certainly wasn't true of Drusus Achaemenion. So she'd waited, assuming that time and habit would return the two old friends to their old understanding. For some reason, the notion that Kellis, and not Zynemus, lay at the root of his distress never occurred to her. Kellis was holy. She harbored absolutely no doubt about that now. He was a prophet, whether he himself believed it or not, and sorcery was unholy. What was it Achaemenion had said he would become? A god sorcerer. Achaemenion continued to fuss over his baggage. He hadn't said anything. He didn't need to.
"But how could it be?" she asked.
Achaemenion paused, stared at nothing for several heartbeats. Then he turned to her, his face blank with hope and horror. "How could a prophet speak blasphemy?" he said, and she knew that for him this was already an old and embittered question. "I asked him that."
"And what did he say?"
"He cursed and insisted he wasn't a prophet. He was offended, hurt even." "I've a talent for that," his tone said. A sudden desperation welled in Esmanet's throat.
"You can't teach him, Akka. You mustn't teach him, don't you see? You're the temptation. He must resist you and the promise of power you hold. He must deny you to become what he must become."
"Is that what you think?" Akkamian exclaimed. "That I'm King Shaikol tempting Sejanus with worldly power like in the tractate? Maybe he's right, Esme. Did you ever consider that? Maybe he's not a prophet."
Esmanet stared at him, fearful, bewildered, but strangely exhilarated as well. How had she come so far? How could a whore from a Sumni slum stand here, so near the world's heart? How had her life become scripture? For a moment, she couldn't believe.
"The question, Akka, is what do you think?"
Akkamian looked to the ground between them. "What do I think?" he repeated pensively. He raised his eyes. Esmanet said nothing, though she felt the hardness melt from her gaze. Akkamian shrugged and sighed. "That the Three Seas couldn't be more unprepared for a second apocalypse. The Heron Spear is lost, shrank Rome half the world, in numbers 100, 1,000 times greater than in Sesswatha's day, and men hold only a fraction of the trinkets." He stared at her, and it seemed his eyes had never been so bright.
"Though the gods have damned me, damned us, I can't believe they would so abandon the world."
"Kellis," she whispered.
Akkamian nodded. "They've sent us more than a harbinger. That's what I think, or hope. I don't know.
But sorcery, Akka, is blasphemy, I know. But ask yourself, Esme, why are sorcerers blasphemers? And why is a prophet a prophet?"
Her eyes opened horror wide.
"Because one sings the God's song," she replied, "and the other speaks the God's voice."
"Exactly," Akkamian said. "Is it blasphemy for a prophet to utter sorcery?"
Esmanet stood staring, dumbstruck.
"For the God to sing his own song? Akka!"
He turned back to his mule, bent to retrieve his satchel from the dust. A sudden panic welled through her.
"Please don't leave me, Akka."
"I told you, Esme," he said without turning his face to her. "I need to think."
"But we think so well together."
He was wiser for her counsel. He knew this. Now he confronted a decision unlike any other. So why would he leave her? Was there something else? Something more he was hiding? She glimpsed him writhing beneath Serwe.
"He's found a younger whore,"
something whispered.
"Why do you do this?"
she asked, her voice far sharper than she had wished. An exasperated pause.
"Do what?" "It's like a labyrinth with you, Akka. You throw open gates, invite me in, but refuse to show me the way. Why do you always hide?"
Her eyes flashed with inexplicable anger.
"Me?"
he laughed, turning back to his task.
"Hide, you say?"
"Yes, hide. You're so weak, Akka. And you need not be. Think of what Kellis has taught us."
He glanced at her, his eyes poised between hurt and fury.
"How about you? Let's talk about your daughter. Remember her? How long has it been since you've—"
"That's different. She came before you, before you." "Why would he say this? Why would he try to hurt? My girl, my baby girl is dead."
"Such fine discriminations," Akkamian spat. "The past is never dead, Esme." He laughed bitterly.
"It's not even past."
"Then where's my daughter, Akka?"
For an instant, he stood dumbstruck. She often baffled him like this.
"Broken down fool."
Her fingers started shaking. Hot tears spilled across her cheeks. How could she think such things?
"Because of what he said. How dare he?"
He gaped at her, as though somehow reading her soul.
"I'm sorry, Esme,"
he said vaguely. I shouldn't have said what I said." His voice trailed away, and he again turned to his mule, began angrily cinching straps. "You don't understand what the Gnosis is to us," he added. "More than my pulse would be forfeit."
"Then teach me. Show me how to understand." "This is Kellis. We discovered him together."
"Esme, I can't talk to you about this. I can't."
"But why?"
"Because I know what you'll say."
"No, Akka,"
she said, feeling the old whorish coldness.
"You don't. You've no idea."
He caught the rough hemp cord hanging from his mule's crude bridle, momentarily fumbled it. For an instant, everything about him, his sandals, his baggage, his white linen robe, seemed lonely and poor. Why did he always look so poor? She thought of Sarcellus, bold, sleek, and perfumed.
Shabby cuckold.
"I'm not leaving you, Esme," he said with a queer kind of finality. "I could never leave you. Not again."
"I see but one sleeping mat," she said.
He tried to smile, then turned, leading Daybreak away at an awkward gait. She watched him, her innards churning as though she dangled over unseen heights. He followed the path eastward, passing a row of weather-beaten round tents. He seemed so small so quickly. It was so strange the way bright sun could make distant figures dark.
"Akka!"
she cried out, not caring who heard.
"Akka!"
"I love you." The figure with the mule stopped, distant and for a moment unrecognizable. He waved. Then he disappeared beneath a stand of black willows. Intelligent people, a Kamian had found, were typically less happy. The reason for this was simple. They were better able to rationalize their delusions. The ability to stomach truth had little to do with intelligence. Nothing, in fact. The intellect was far better at arguing away truths than at finding them, which was why he had to flee Kellis and Esmanet. He led his mule along a path bounded to his right by the black expanse of the Sempis, and to his left by a line of gigantic eucalyptus trees. Save for the odd flash of warmth between limbs, the half-canopy sheltered him from the sun. A breeze seeped through his white linen tunic. It was peaceful, he thought, to at long last be alone. When Zynemus had told him that certain books pertaining to the Gnosis had been found in the Seriotic Library, he could read the subtext well enough. "You should leave," his friend had said without saying. Ever since the night with the Wathidal, a Kamian had expected to be banished from his friend's fire, even if temporarily. Even more, he needed to be banished, to be forced from the company of those who overwhelmed him. But it cut, nonetheless. No matter, he told himself. Just another feud born of the awkwardness of their friendship, a caste noble and a sorcerer. "There is no friend more difficult," one of the poets of the Tusk had written, "than a sinner." And a Kamian was nothing if not a sinner. Unlike some sorcerers, he rarely pondered the fact of his damnation. For much the same reason, he imagined, men who beat their wives didn't ponder their fists. But there were other reasons. In his youth, he'd been one of those students who delighted in irreverence and impiousness, as though the mortal blasphemy he learned licensed any blasphemy, large and small. He and Sankla, his cellmate in at Ursus, used to actually read the tractate aloud and laugh at its absurdities. The passages dealing with the circumcision of caste priests, and of course, the passages dealing with manural purification rites. But one passage, more than any other, would haunt him over the years. The famous, "Expect not admonition," from the Book of Priests.
"Listen," Sankla had cried from his pallet one night. "And the letter prophet said, piety is not the province of money changers. Do not give food for food, shelter for shelter, love for love. Do not throw the good upon the balance, but give without expectation. Give food for nothing, shelter for nothing, love for nothing. Yield unto him who trespasses against you. For these things alone the wicked do not do. Expect not, and you shall find glory everlasting."
The older boy fixed a Kamian with his dark, always laughing eyes, eyes that would make them lovers for a time.
"Can you believe it?"
"Believe what?" a Kamian asked. He already laughed because he knew that whatever Sankla cooked up was certain to be deliriously funny. He was simply one of those people. His death in Aeoknissus 3 years later, he'd been killed by a drunken caste noble with a trinket, would crush a Kamian. Sankla tapped the scroll with his forefinger, something that would have earned him a beating in the scriptorium.
Essentially, Sejanus is saying, give without expectation of reward, and you can expect a huge reward.
Akamian frowned.
Don't you see? Sankla continued. He's saying that piety consists of good acts in the absence of selfish expectation. He's saying you give nothing, nothing, when you expect something in exchange. You simply don't give.
Akamian caught his breath.
So the Enrithi who expect to be exalted in the outside... Give nothing, Sankla had said, laughing in disbelief. Nothing! But we, on the other hand, dedicate our lives to continuing Seswatha's battle. We give everything, and we can expect only damnation as a result. We're the only ones, Akka.
We're the only ones. As tempting as those words were, as moving and as important as they'd been... Akamian had become too much a skeptic to trust them. They were too flattering, too self-aggrandizing to be true. So instead, he'd thought it simply had to be enough to be a good man. And if it wasn't enough, then there was nothing good about those who measured good and evil, which was likely the case. But of course, Kellis had changed everything. Akamian now pondered his damnation a great deal. Before, the question of his damnation had merely seemed an excuse for self-torment. The tusk in the tractate couldn't be more clear, though Akamian had read many heretical works suggesting that the scriptures' manifold and manifest contradictions proved that the prophets, olden day and latter, were simply men, which they were. All heaven, Protathus had once written, cannot shine through a single crack. So there was room to doubt his damnation. Perhaps, as Sankla had suggested, the damned were in fact the elect. Or perhaps, as Akamian was more inclined to believe, the uncertain were the chosen ones. He'd often thought the temptation to assume, to sham certainty, was the most narcotic and destructive of all temptations. To do good without certainty was to do good without expectation. Perhaps doubt itself was the key. But then, of course, the question could never be answered. If genuine doubt was, in fact, the condition of conditions, then only those ignorant of the answer could be redeemed. To ponder the question of his damnation, it had always seemed, was itself a kind of damnation. So he didn't think of it. But now there could be an answer. Every day he walked with its possibility, talked. Prince Anasarimba Kellis. It wasn't as though he thought Kellis could simply tell him the answer, even if he could ever summon the courage to ask. Nor did he think that Kellis somehow embodied or exemplified the answer. That would make him too small. He was not in some mystic non-man fashion, the living sign of Drusus Akamian's fate, no. The question of his damnation or his exaltation, Akamian knew, depended on what he himself was willing to sacrifice. He himself would answer the question with his actions. And as much as this knowledge horrified him, it also filled him with an abiding and incredulous joy. The fear it engendered was old. For some time he'd feared the fate of the entire world depended on those self-same actions. He'd grown numb to consequences of deranged proportions. But the joy was something new, something unexpected. Anasarimba Kellis had made salvation a real possibility. Salvation. Though you lose your soul, the Mandate Catechism began, you shall win the world. But it need not be. Akamian knew that now. Finally, he could see how desolate, how bereft of hope his prior life had been. Esmanet had taught him how to love. And Kellis. Anasarimba Kellis had taught him how to hope, and he would seize them, love and hope. He would seize them, and he would hold them fast. He need only decide what to do. Akka, Kellis had said the previous night, I need ask you something. Only the two of them sat about the fire. They boiled water for some midnight tea.
Anything, Kellis, a commune replied.
What troubles you?
I'm troubled by what I must ask.
Never had a commune seen such a poignant expression, as though horror had been bent to the point where it kissed rapture. A mad urge to shield his eyes almost overcame him.
What you must ask?
Kellis had nodded.
Each day, Akka, I am less myself. Such words!
Their mere memory struck him breathless. Standing in an islet of sunlight, a commune paused along the trail, pressed his palms to his chest. A cloud of birds erupted into the sky. Their shadows flickered across him, soundless. He blinked at the sun.
Do I teach him the gnosis?
To his gut, he balked at the notion. The mere thought of surrendering the gnosis to someone outside his school made him blanch. He wasn't even sure he could teach Kellis the gnosis, even if he desired. His knowledge of the gnosis was the one thing he shared with Seswatha, whose imprint owned every movement of his slumbering soul.
Will you let me? Do you see what I see?
Never, never in the history of their school had a sorcerer of rank betrayed the gnosis. Only the gnosis had allowed the mandate to survive. Only the gnosis had allowed them to carry Seswatha's war through the millennia. Lose it, and they became no more than a minor school. His brothers, a commune knew, would fight themselves to extinction to prevent that from happening. They would hunt both of them without relenting, and they would kill them if they could. They would not listen to reasons. And the name, Drusus Akamian, would become a curse in the dark halls of Atyrsus. But what was this other than greed or jealousy? The second apocalypse was imminent. Hadn't the time come to arm all the three seas? Hadn't Seswatha himself bid them share their arsenal before the shadow fell? He had. And wouldn't this make Akamian the most faithful of all mandate schoolmen? He resumed walking as though in a stupor. In his bones, he knew that Kellis had been sent. The peril was too great, and the promise too breathtaking. He'd watched as Kellis consumed a lifetime of knowledge in the space of months. He'd listened, breathless, as Kellis voiced truths of thought more subtle than a Gensis, and truths of passion more profound than Sejanus. He'd sat in the dust, gaping as the man extended the geometries of Muratitis beyond the limits of comprehension, as he corrected the ancient logic, then drafted new logics, the way a child might scribble spirals with a stick. What would the gnosis be to such a man? A plaything? What would he discover? What power would he wield? Glimpses of Kellis striding as a god across fields of war, laying low host of Srank, striking dragons from the sky, closing with a resurrected no-god, with dread Mog Farrow. He's our savior, I know it! But what if Esmanet were right? What if a commune were merely the test? Like old evil Shykol in the Tractate, offering Inri Sejanus his thigh-bone scepter, his army, his harem, everything, save his crown, to stop preaching. Akamian halted once again, was bumped forward 2 steps by his mule, Daybreak. Stroking his snout, he smiled in the lonely way of men with hapless animals. A breeze swept across the shining reaches of the Sempus, hissing through the trees. He began trembling. Prophet and sorcerer. The Tusk called such men shaman. The word lay like a ziggurat in his thoughts, immovable. Shaman.
No, this is madness! For 2,000 years, Mandate schoolmen had kept the gnosis safe. 2,000 years! Who was he to forsake such tradition?
Nearby, a crowd of young children was gathered beneath the sweep of a sycamore, chirping and jostling like sparrows over spilled bread. And Akamian saw 2 young boys, no more than 4 or 5, making arm-waving declarations, each with a hand firmly clasped in the hand of the other. The innocence of the act struck him, and he found himself wondering how old they would be when they saw the error of holding hands. Or would they discover Kellis? A whining sound drew his eyes upward. He nearly cried out in shock.
A naked corpse had been nailed to the rafters of the tree above, purple and marbled with black-green. After the surprise passed, he thought of kicking or cutting the man down. But then, where would he carry him? To some nearby village? The Shigeki were so terrified of the Enrithi, he'd be surprised if they looked at him, let alone touched him. A pang of remorse struck him, and inexplicably, he thought of Esmanette.
Be safe.
Leading Daybreak, Akamian continued past the children, through the sun-dappled shade and toward Iothea, the ancient capital of the Shigeki god-kings, whose walls wandered across the distance, belts of faint stone glimpsed through dark eucalyptus limbs. Akamian walked and wrestled with impossibilities. The past was dead, the future as black as a waiting grave. Akamian wiped his tears on his shoulder. Something unimaginable was about to happen. Something historians, philosophers, and theologians would argue for thousands of years, if years or anything else survived. And the acts of Drusus Akamian would loom so very large. He would simply give, without expectation, his school, his calling, his life. The Gnosis would be his sacrifice. Behind her mighty curtain walls, Iothea was a warren of four-story mud-brick buildings welded continuously together. The alleyways were narrow, screened from above by palm-leaf awnings, so that Akamian felt as though he walked through desert tunnels. He avoided the Karathotics. He didn't like the look of triumph in their eyes. But when he encountered armed men of the Tusk, he would ask them for directions, and then pick his way through a further welter of alleys. The fact that most of the Enrithi he encountered were Enani concerned him, and once or twice, when the walls opened enough for him to spy the monuments of the city, he thought he could sense the deep bruise of the scarlet spires somewhere in the distance. But then he encountered a troop of Norserai horsemen, Galioth, they said, and he was somewhat relieved. Yes, they knew how to find the Seriotic Library. Yes, the library was in Galioth's hands. Akamian lied, as he always lied, and told them that he was a scholar, come to chronicle the exploits of the Holy War. As always, their eyes brightened at the thought of finding some small mention in the annals of written history. They instructed him to follow as best he could, claiming they would pass the library on their way to wherever it was they were stationed. Noon saw him in the shadow of the library, more apprehensive than ever. If rumors of the existence of Gnostic texts had reached him, wouldn't they also have reached the Scarlet Spires? The thought of jostling for scrolls with a red-robed schoolman filled him with more than a little dread. What do you think? He asked Daybreak, who snorted and nosed his palm. The idea that Gnostic texts might have lain hidden here all this time wasn't as preposterous as it seemed. The library was as old as the Thousand Temples, built and maintained by the Seriots, an esoteric college of priests dedicated to the preservation of knowledge. There was a time, during the Canaan Empire, when it was law in Iothea for all those entering the city in possession of a book to surrender it to the Seriots so that it might be copied. The problem, however, was that the Seriotic College was a religious institution, and as such, it necessarily forbade any of the few from entering the famed library. When many centuries later the Seriots were massacred by the Fainim in the fall of Shigek, it was rumored that the Padaraja himself had entered the library. From his vest, the legend went, he pulled a slender leather-bound copy of the Kipfa Afan, the witness of Fain, bent to the shape of his breast. Holding it high in the airy gloom, he declared, "Here lies all written truth. Here lies the one path for all souls. Burn this wicked place." At that instant, it was said, a single scroll spilled from the racks and came rolling to his booted feet. When the Padaraja opened it, he found a detailed map of all Gadea, which he later used to crush the Nansur in a number of desperate battles. The library was spared. But if it was closed to schoolmen under the Seriots, it might well have ceased to exist under the Kianine. There very well could be Gnostic texts in this library, Akamian knew. They'd been discovered before. If there were any reason, aside from their dreams of the old wars, why the sorcerers of the Mandate were the most scholarly of the schoolmen, it was their jealousy of the Gnosis. The Gnosis gave them a power far out of proportion to the size of their school. If a school like the Scarlet Spires were to come into its possession, who could say what might happen? Things wouldn't fare well with the Mandate, that much was certain. But then, all that was about to change, now that an Anassarimber had returned. Akamian led his mule into the middle of a small walled courtyard. The cobble had long ago been ground into red dust, save for the odd stones surfacing here and there like turtle shells. The library itself presented the square front of a Canaan temple, with columns soaring to brace a crumbling lintel pocked by figures that may have once been gods or men. Two large Galioth swordsmen reclined in the shade against the two pillars flanking the entrance. They acknowledged him with bored stares as he approached. "Greetings," he called, hoping they spoke Shaik. "I am Drusus Istaphis, chronicler to Prince Nerse Proyas of Conraya." When they failed to reply, he paused. Akamian found himself particularly unnerved by the one with a scar that dimpled his face from his hairline to his chin. These didn't seem like friendly men. But then, what cheer would a warrior find guarding something as useless as books? Akamian cleared his throat. "Have there been many other visitors to the library?"
"No,"
the scarless man replied, shrugging his shoulders beneath his hauberk.
"Just a few thieving merchants is all."
The man spat something across the dust, and Akamian realized he'd been sucking on a peach pit. "Well, I can assure you I'm not of that caste. Assuredly not." Then, with a mixture of curiosity and deference, "Do I have your leave to enter?" The man nodded to his mule.
"Can't bring that thing," he said. "Can't have a donkey shitting in our hallowed halls now, can we?"
He smirked and turned to his scarred friend, who continued to stare at Akamian. He looked like a bored boy deciding whether to poke a dead fish. After gathering several things from his mule, Akamian rushed up the steps past the two guards. The great doors were gilded in tarnished bronze, and one of them lay ajar enough to admit a single man. As Akamian ducked into the gloom, he heard one of the Galioth, the scarred one, he thought, mutter,
"Filthy pick."
But the old Norserai slur didn't bother him. Rather, he was excited. A sudden urge to cackle almost overcame him. Only now, it seemed, did the fact that this was the Sariotic library fully strike him. The damned Sariots, hoarding text after text for over 1,000 years. What might he find? Absolutely anything, and not just Gnostic works, might lie hidden within. The 9 classics, the early dialogues of Inseruti, even the lost works of Agensis. He passed through the darkness of a great vaulted antechamber, across a mosaic floor that once, he decided, had portrayed Inri Sejanus holding out haloed hands, at least before the Phanum, who'd obviously never used this place, had defaced it. He retrieved a candle from his saddlebag and ignited it with a secretive word. Holding the small point of light before him, he plunged into the hallowed halls of the library. The Sariotic library was a warren of pitch-black hallways that smelled of dust and the ghost of rotting books. Englobed by light, Akamian wandered through the blackness and filled his arms with treasures. Never had he seen such a collection. Never had he witnessed so many ruined thoughts. Out of the thousands of volumes and thousands upon thousands of scrolls, Akamian would be surprised if more than several hundred could be salvaged. He found nothing that even hinted at the Gnosis, but he did, nevertheless, find several things of peculiar interest. He found one book by Agensis he'd never seen before, but it was written in Vaparsi, an ancient Nil-Nemeshi language he knew well enough only to decipher the title. The fourth dialogue of the movements of the planets as they pertain to something or another. But the fact that this was a dialogue meant that it was exceedingly important. Very few of the great Kyrenian philosopher's dialogues survived. He found a heap of clay tablets written in the cuneiform script of ancient Shigek and draped by cobwebs woolen with dust. He retrieved one that seemed in good shape and decided he would try to smuggle it out, even though it might be a granary inventory for all he knew. It would make a good gift, he thought, for Zynemus. And he found other tomes and scrolls, curiosities mostly, an account of the age of warring cities by a historian he'd never encountered before, a strange vellum-paged book called On the Temples and Their Iniquities, which made him wonder if the Sariots might not have had heretical leanings, and some others. After a time, both his excitement at finding things intact and his outrage at finding them destroyed flagged. He tired, and finding a stone bench in a niche, he arranged his discoveries and his humble belongings around him as though they were totems in a magic circle, then ate some stale bread and drank wine from his skin. He thought of Esmanette while he ate, cursed himself for his sudden longing. He did his best not to think of Kellis. He replaced his sputtering candle and decided to read, alone with books, yet again. Suddenly he smiled. Again? No. At last. A book was never read. Here as elsewhere, language betrayed the true nature of the activity. To say that a book was read was to make the same mistake as the gambler who crowed about winning, as though he'd taken it by force of hand or resolve. To toss the number sticks was to seize a moment of helplessness, nothing more. But to open a book was by far the more profound gamble. To open a book was not only to seize a moment of helplessness, not only to relinquish a jealous handful of heartbeats to the unpredictable mark of another man's quill, it was to allow oneself to be written. For what was a book, if not a long consecutive surrender to the movements of another soul? A commune could think of no abandonment of self more profound. He read, and was moved to chuckle by ironies 1,000 years dead, and to reflect pensively on claims and hopes that had far outlived the age of their import. He wouldn't remember falling asleep. There was a dragon in his dream, old, hoary, terrible, and malevolent beyond compare. Scuthela, whose limbs were like knotted iron, and whose black wings, when he descended, were broad enough to blot half the sky. The great fountain of luminescent fire that vomited from Scuthela's maw burnt the sand around his wards to glass, and Seswatha fell to one knee, tasted blood. But the old sorcerer's head was thrown back, his white hair whipped into ribbons by the wind of beating dragon wings, and the impossible words thundered like laughter from his incandescent mouth. Needles of piercing light filled the sky. But the corners of this scene were crimped, and then suddenly, as though dreams were painted across parchment, it crumpled and was tossed into blackness. The blackness of open eyes. Gasping breath. Where was he? The library, yes. The candle must have gone out. But then he realized just what had awakened him. His wards of exposure, which he'd maintained ever since joining the holy... Sweet Sejanus, the scarlet spires. He fumbled in the darkness, gathered his satchel. Quickly, quickly. He stood in the blackness and peered with different eyes. The chamber was long, with low ceilings, and galleried by rows of racks and shelves. The intruders were somewhere near, hastening between queues of moldering knowledge, closing on him from various points throughout the library. Did they come for the Gnosis? Knowledge ever found itself on the scales of greed, and no knowledge in the three C's, perhaps, was as valuable as the Gnosis. But to abduct a mandate schoolman in the midst of the Holy War? One would think the Scarlet Spires would have more pressing concerns, like the Kishorum. One would think. But what of the Skin Spies? What of the Consult? They'd known he was bound to investigate even the rumor of a Gnostic text, and they had known a library would be where he felt safest. Who would risk such treasures? Certainly not fellow schoolmen, no matter how ill their will. The entire thing, he realized, was an outrageously extravagant trap, a trap that had included Zynemus. What better way to lull an ever-suspicious mandate schoolman than to dangle the lure through the lips of his most trusted friend? Zynemus? No, it couldn't be. Sweet Sejanus, this was actually happening. Akamian grabbed his satchel and lunged through the blackness, crashed into a heavy rack of scrolls, felt papyrus crumble in his fingers, like the mud that skins the bottom of dried puddles. He thrust his satchel into the leafy debris, quickly, quickly. Then he stumbled back in the direction he'd come. They were closer now. Light smeared the ceiling over the black shelves facing him. He backed into the small alcove where he'd snoozed, then began uttering a series of words, short strings of impossible thoughts. Light flashed from his lips. Luminescence sheeted the air before him like the glare of sunlight across mist. Dark muttering from somewhere amid the teetering cues, skulking, insinuating words, like vermin gnawing at the walls of the world. Then, fierce light, transforming, for a heartbeat, the shelves before him into a dawn horizon. Explosion, a geyser of ash and fire. The concussion sucked the air from his lungs. The heat cracked the stone of the surrounding walls, but his wards held. Akamian blinked. A moment of relative darkness.
Yield, Drusus Akamian. You're overmatched.
Eleazarus? He cried. How many times have you fools tried to wrest the Gnosis from us? Tried and failed!
Shallow breath, hammering heart.
Eleazarus? You're doomed, Akamian. Would you doom the riches about you as well?
As precious as they were, the words rolled and stacked about him meant nothing. Not now.
Don't do this, Eleazarus! He cried in a breaking voice. The stakes! The stakes!
It's already...
But Akamian had whispered secrets to his first attacker. Five lines glittered along the gorge of blasted shelves through smoke and wafting pages. Impact! The air cracked. His unseen foe cried out in astonishment. They always did at the first touch of the Gnosis. Akamian muttered more ancient words of power, more cants. The bisecting planes of Mirsior, to continuously stress an opponent's wards, the Odani concussion cants to stun him, break his concentration, then the Siroi loom. Dazzling geometries leapt through the smoke, lines and parabolas of razor light, punching through wood and papyrus, shearing through stone. The Scarlet Schoolman screamed, tried to run. Akamian boiled him in his skin. Darkness, save for glowering fires scattered through the ruin. Akamian could hear the other schoolmen shouting to each other in shock and dismay. He could feel them scramble among the queues, hasten to assemble a concert.
Think on this, Eleazarus. How many are you willing to sacrifice?
Please, don't be a...
The roar of flame, the thunder of toppling shelves, fire broke like foaming surf about his wards, a blinding flash illuminating the vast chamber from corner to corner, the crack of thunder. Akamian stumbled to his knees. His wards groaned in his thoughts. He struck back with inference and abstraction. He was a mandate schoolman, a Gnostic sorcerer of the rank, a war cant master. He was as a mask held before the sun, and his voice slapped the distances into char and ruin. The hoarded knowledge of the Sariots was blasted and burned. Convections whipped pages into fiery cyclones. Like leathery moths, books spiraled into the debris. Dragon's fire cascaded between the surviving shelves. Lightning spidered the air, crackled across his defenses. The last cues fell, and across the ruin, Akamian glimpsed his assailants. Seven of them, like silk scarlet dancers in a field of funeral pyres. The schoolmen of the Scarlet Spires. The glimpse of tempests disgorging bolts of blinding white, the heads of phantom dragons dipping and belching fire, the sweep of burning sparrows, the great analogies, shining and ponderous, crashing and thundering about his wards, and through them, the abstractions, glittering and instantaneous. The seventh Kuyan theorem, the ellipses of Thessalonicus. He yelled out the impossible words. The leftmost scarlet schoolman screamed. The ghostly ramparts about him crumbled beneath an arcana of encircling lines. The library walls behind him exploded outward, and he was puffed like paper into the evening sky. For a moment, Akamian abandoned the cants, began singing to save his wards. Cataracts of hellfire. The floor failed. Great ceilings of stone clapped about him like angry palms to prayer. He fell through fire and rolling megalithic ruin. But still, he sang. He was a scion of Seswatha, a disciple of Noshainrau the White. He was the slayer of Skafra, mightiest of the Raku. He had pitched his song against the dread heights of Golgotharoth. He had stood proud and impenitent before Mog-Pharao himself. Jarring impact, different footing, like the pitched deck of a ship, shrugging slabs and heaped ruin away, tossing thundering stone into sky, plunging through meaning after dark meaning, the hard matter of the world collapsing, falling away like lover's clothing, all in answer to his singing song. And at last, the sky, so water cool when seen from the inferno's heart. And there, the nail of heaven, silvering the breast of a rare cloud. The Sariotic library was a furnace in the husk of ragged, freestanding walls. And above, the scarlet magi hung as though from wires, and pummeled him with cant after wicked cant. The heads of ghostly dragons reared and vomited lakes of fire, rising and spitting, racking him with dazzling, bone-snapping fire. Sun after blinding sun set upon him. On his knees, burned, bleeding from mouth and eyes, encircled by heaped stone and text, Akamian snarled ward after ward, but they cracked and shattered, were pinched away like rotted linen. The very firmament, it seemed, echoed the implacable chorus of the scarlet spires. Like angry smiths, they punished the anvil. And through the madness, Drusus Akamian glimpsed the setting sun, impossibly indifferent, framed by clouds piled rose and orange. It was, he thought, a good song. Forgive me, Kellis.